Is it on?
Yeah, I just want to get it. Okay, now let's just see how we're talking.
Yeah.
Just.
I came to Lakeville in the fall of 1931.
Okay, let's stop that and see how it goes. Okay, this is Jody Stone interviewing George Dwight Kellogg Jr. on the 14th of July, 1986, at his home on Robin Hill Lane in Lakeville.
Okay, I came to Lakeville for the high school in the fall of 1931. And as a student, I didn't become involved in the town very much, but I do remember certain minor things. For instance, the road from Millerton past Interlaken came up by Town Hill School, went right through the middle of Hotchkiss and came out at the Four Corners. Later on, of course, it would change to Route 112 as far as now. I remember in the fall of 1931 that we had polio at Hotchkiss and in Lakeville. And in 1931, they didn't know very much about polio. And at least four or five boys came down with minor or major forms of polio. And the whole school was sent home around Thanksgiving time in the fall of 31. And we didn't come back until the day after Christmas. I know at that time that Ed Pavola, a day student at Hotchkiss and the son of the Mr. and Mrs. Pavola ran the Lakeville Variety, got polio in his throat, but got over it with a minor speech impediment. I think that Jeanette Axelby, who later worked at the bank, maybe got polio at the same time, but I'm not sure. Other things that I remember my first few years as a student at Hotchkiss are, of course, that the center of Lakeville, where the Lakeville Cafe is now, was much different. In the middle of the intersection in the old days was a monument with a plaque on it telling you how far it was to Hartford or Albany or Poughkeepsie or whatever. It stood right in the middle of the intersection and is of course not there now. I haven't any idea where it is. I've asked both North Minor and Charlotte Reed if they know. If they don't, it's too bad that we can't find it. It's a nice relic of the past. In the center of Lakeville, where the Lakeville Cafe is now, was a large building or a series of buildings. I remember the post office was there. There's a barber shop. This is Judd's barber shop was there. Of course, the Lakeville wine shop was there. The present apothecary was Rudman's Market. On the other side of the street, of course, Dufour's Garage took up quite a bit of it. And back toward the Catholic Church, along there came Heaton Barnett's dry goods store, a great big wooden building, which later was torn down gradually. I remember at some point in the 40s, there was still part of it there, where the Western Union office and where Argyle's barbershop was located. Argyle was certainly a barber in the 1940s, because I remember it was rather annoying because he moonlighted working at the magnesium plant in Canaan at night, and often he was too tired to come to work in the morning. He had a cute trick, and that was if you were waiting for a haircut, you didn't have to wait in the shop. As long as you were sitting on the porch, you could count it. So you can avoid the smell of cigarettes and the cigars. I remember that as a student, we were allowed to come to Lakeville almost any time we were free in the afternoons. There was no halfway house to go to. There was no snack bar at school. So students came down the hill on foot. We weren't allowed to take taxis. And we stopped either at the Jigger Shop, which was located in the building now occupied by the laundry, or we went to Liberty's drugstore up at the corner at the top of the hill above A&E. Of course, that building is torn down now, and there's a little park in its place. But when Liberty was running that drugstore, it was a favorite place to go for two reasons. One, he had good sodas, and two, he had the only supply of magazines in the area. He was rather nasty about boys reading magazines without buying them, but he could just bark at us. It was very much very little he could do. I remember, would yell at the boys to close the door, and his favorite expression was, "Were you brought up in a bonnet?" We often thought it would have been easier if he put a door closer on the door and he wouldn't have had to be upset. Working in the Liberty's drugstore was Tony Gentile as an assistant. And later on he left Liberty and went to work in Canaan. And then he, of course, worked in the apothecary shop or whatever we call it in Lakewood. The Jigger Shop, which I mentioned before, was operated by two elderly ladies. I think one of them was a Mrs. Ann. And it was a favorite place to go because it was the nearest high school. And it was home. Also, I remember that in the back room of the Jigger Shop, they would have displays of men's or boys' clothing brought up to Lakeville from New Haven and New York by such outfits as Jay Press, Finchley, I don't think Brooks Brothers, but they all came, and in those days, apparently, they sold rather fancy clothes to Hotchkiss students in particular, and perhaps to some locals too. I know that if you are walking from the Catholic Church down toward the middle of Lakeville, there's a storefront house on the left, on the right, excuse me, down close to the Jigger Shop. And that at one point was a dry cleaning outfit, and then another time was a place where tailors displayed their goods. Frank Mercer, who was golf pro at Hotchkiss in the old days, would, I know, have Spaldings bring their clothes and their sporting goods to his golf shop at Hotchkiss, but also he had a store on the street down to Lakeville. I think maybe that was after he retired from Hotchkiss. In the middle of Lakeville, the railroad continued to bring freight anyway from the east across the Route 41, across the bridge, and it stopped just past the station. I don't believe it went any further than that. And in my day, it certainly didn't bring passengers at all. And I know it brought coal and oil to the community service. The Life Factory was operating to some extent in those days, but because I remember one year going down there, climbing the stairs to their showroom, and buying a pocket knife for my father for Christmas. It was a beautiful little knife with buffalo horn handle. On our holidays, of course, we went to the caves. Almost everybody went to the caves once in their 4 years of high school. We climbed Lion's Head Mountain often. One time in the ninth grade, that would have been 31 to 32. We got a ride to Sages Ravine, and then we climbed up Sages Ravine to the Appalachian Trail, and all the way to Mount Everett. Came back, stopped at Berkshire, watched the track meet, started back toward Lakeville, and one of our members was so tired by the time we reached to what is now the Stagecoach Inn that he couldn't go an inch further. And so after some consultation, we called the school and got permission to get a taxi to take us back to school. We met the taxi, I remember, at the Massachusetts-Connecticut state line. That was a big event to get a taxi at all. Another thing we did on holidays was to go down the Housatonic by canoe. In those days, a lot of canoes were owned by high school students. And on a holiday, we called Duke First Garage. They would come in a truck. We'd load the canoes in the truck. They'd take us to the bridge by the Housatonic Valley Regional High School. We'd start from that bridge, and we'd paddle all the way down the Goose, under the covered bridge, over the rapids. In some cases, we carried the canoes back up, so we went through the rapids several times. Ended up very wet, muddy, and tired at the Kent School in Kent. And Father Sills, the headmaster, was very pleasant. He would invite us into his study, give us cocoa, and from there we would call Dufours, and he'd come back down in his truck and take the canoes back to school. It was a simple operation, and Dufour was very cooperative. As far as inns are concerned, I don't remember the Interlochen much at all, except as a fire trap. Wake Robin Inn was, in those days, quite pleasant. It was more like a tea room than it was a bar and grill, which was the sort of place that your mother liked to take you to lunch when she came down. In the fall of 1934, Hotchkiss beat Hill in football, which was fairly unusual. As a result, we had a large bonfire. Was sanctioned by the headmaster, who helped build this tremendous bonfire. And we all went out in the country to get wood for the bonfire. Some members of my class came back with a privy, which they put on fire, and which subsequently was burned up. It turned out that the privy was actually in use, and the school was in sort of a jam, and my friends had to chip in and pay for a new privy. Another jam that they got the school into was on a holiday when some football players were walking through the country and they saw a lot of corn shucks, or you call them shocks, were standing in the field, and they thought, wouldn't it be fun to tackle them, like tackling them. They left the field with the corn shocks strewn over the ground, and later on they all had to go back and set them up straight again. That's about all I remember important during my 4 years as a student. But I returned in September 1942, and things were pretty much the same. The war was on. I do remember that Hotchkiss had only one school car. This was a Buick, I think, driven by Frank Engel, and it took the headmaster to meetings, and it met trains in Millerton and so forth. There were no trucks at all. There was a 1937 Ford ambulance that had been given to the school by Edsel Ford. This ambulance was in operation for a long time. It was kept in the barn near where Frank Ingram lived, and he drove it when it was called. And I remember that Bill Black, who worked as a employee of the athletic department would go along, I think, to help load people into these ambulances. As I remember, this was the only ambulance in the area. There was no Salisbury, Sharon, no Canaan ambulance. The school had no trucks, but they had, I think, two teams of horses. In the winter, they pulled sleds, or in the spring and the summer, they pulled carts, and these were used to deliver laundry, dirt, anything else that the school had to carry them in. Later on, perhaps at the end of the war, they rented a truck from Dufour's garage for several years before they finally bought one truck. By this time, there were, as far as I remember, two barbers in town. Argyle was still there. Chet Thurston was new to me. He had a shop in the same building that where Bob Fiengo had a shop now. Later on, Thurston died. And Fiengo came up to Lakeville from Kent, where he had been living and cutting hair. Fiengo's still here. Argyle was there. Along the main street from the Gulf Station toward where the Lakeville Cafe is, there was an A&P store, I remember, and what was left of Heaton Barnett. And eventually all of that was torn down. The entrance to the ball field was improved, and of course the gas station went through several changes. In the 40s, I remember that taxis were run by Harry Ablahadian, who had a garage up where the community fuel is now. He had something to do also with a bus service or a van service that had sort of elongated airport limousine cars that would take you from Poughkeepsie to Hartford. As a matter of fact, you could change in Winston and go to Albany and to New Haven. It was pretty good. Much better, actually, than any transportation now. Telephones in those days were still run by regular human operators. I think our number was 476 or something like that. They had a central office somewhere near where community fuel is now. I remember in those days, during the war, walking to Lakeville in the morning to get a haircut. And I was walking back up the hill, and a nice fellow in a community service truck full of coal stopped. And it was Jimmy Du Bois, who was then working for the community service. And that was the first time I ever met him. And of course, I see him often now. He's been a terrific citizen of this town. I know that sometime during the war in the 40s was a rather bad blizzard, and Farnham Road at some point between Lakeville and Limelight was completely snowed in, and trucks couldn't get through to farmers to bring feed or get milk, or it was completely blocked. And I remember being asked by the headmaster to bring a group of boys to dig out the roadblock. And so I rounded them up, and Charlie Garrity, who was a contractor in the area, who lived, as a matter of fact, in the house where Wim Kerr lives right now, he came up to get us in his truck. He didn't say very much. He just drove us down to the village We turned up Farnham Road. We were on our way toward the roadblock when the left rear wheel of the truck fell off. Charlie said one short four-letter word, got out of the truck, and left. We didn't know what to do, and so we had a snowball fight for a while, and after a long time, another truck came and took us to the roadblock. We dug out the block, at least we made it passable for one lane anyway, and that's about all you can get out of a group of boys. They'll work hard for about 3 quarters an hour, and then it turned into a Japanese bonsai attack with snow. But anyway, as a reward for our services, Bill Barnett took us to the Jigger Shop in the village of Lakeville, supplied us all with sodas, and then we were taken back to school. At this point, that's about all I can remember of interest, except that I was talking about the road up from Town Hill School to Lakeville, to Hotchkiss. And at some point, between the time I graduated from Hotchkiss and came back as a teacher, they moved the road and called it Route 112. In the process, Hotchkiss traded some land, which it was on the golf course, for the land where the old road was. And so it was supposedly a even Steven, no money kind of deal. And the Route 112 went down to the Interlaken, and the paving stopped at the Interlaken. And it was dirt all the way to the Millerton Route 44. At some point, of course, it was paved from Interlaken on through, I don't know when, but it probably was in the 50s. An interesting thing did happen, though, about that land deal, and that was that when Sanford Hall at Hotchkiss, which is near, quite near the cemetery, was being built, they were laying the foundation, and somehow it was discovered that a small section of the foundation was actually on land that belonged to the town of Salisbury. And the surveyor who made the arrangements back several years and apparently miscalculated the area of this road. And so there was Hotchkiss building a building, 95% on Hotchkiss land and 5% on town land. Fortunately, it was in the summer, and they had a special town meeting, and without any negative votes, they were able to deed the land as it should be entirely to Hotchkiss, so the building was on Hotchkiss property. That's all.
Oh, I think you're terrific. Listen, let me ask you a couple of things. Halfway house, you mean the Woodland?
The Woodland,
the Woodland restaurant. The caves, are they on Reese Harris's or Dave Harris's land?
Well, let's say they were on Harris land. Right. I know that in the 40s, Dave Harris got very upset because of the danger that somebody might get trapped down there and die. In fact, we arrived there once, and he wouldn't let it go down. Another time, later on, I remember calling David to ask him for permission to go, and he gave us permission.
You as a student?
Yeah, as a student. And I can see how it would be quite easy to get trapped, because I went down there once. I think the first time I went down there, we didn't have enough flashlights. And the fellow behind me had claustrophobia and was really upset. And you were inching along on your stomach, and he couldn't see. And you could feel the fellow ahead of you who knew where he was going, but you couldn't turn around. You had to either inch backwards or inch forwards. until you got to a big enough space and turn around. I think that all that land was Harris land, and Harris was divided on a bunch of mine. Now, John Harris was a classmate of mine, as was Ed Pavolos. John Harris died of
Were they limestone caves? I mean, yeah. They were big when you got finally in there. Are they big
there were some, to stand but, oh yeah, there were some rooms. Awfully wet. These caves, you got into by going straight down a vertical hole. It was not very well marked. Newer boulders and things, and you inch your way down. And then it leveled out, so it was horizontal. And as you went down the mouth of the cave, down this hole, there were pieces of string where people had tied them. There were signs of candle wax in the caves.
Were there light? Was there light in the cave once you got in?
No.
Nothing.
I have a feeling there might have been another entrance, but I can't remember ever seeing it. I'd never do it again.
You were talking about the road, yeah. Road 112, and you were telling me the other day when they redid 41
coming
out of Hotchkiss Corners.
That's right. The four-way intersection of Hotchkiss used to be a lot higher. As you came up the hill from Lakeville, you climbed a little hill, so you really couldn't see very well. So the state of Connecticut had the brilliant idea of redoing that. And they completely redesigned the intersection, and they dug it down, I think, about 10 feet. It used to be level with Del Pret's front lawn. Now it's about 10 feet below the Del Pret's front lawn. In the process of correcting the corner, of course, they made it absolutely blind for people coming from Lime Rock, so it's perhaps not much of an improvement. In the course of cutting the road down to make this improvement, you could see that there had been another road somewhat, maybe 2 or 3 feet under the old road, so that in the past there had been a lower road which had been built up, and now it's much lower. I haven't any idea. It looked to me like a dirt or crushed stone road that was uncovered when they dug it out. And as I say, I don't think it was a great improvement, and in the process they had to bargain with Ben Belcher. I think they had to condemn some of Ben's land or something. They changed the road on his side, too.
Oh, you mean 41 going down?
Yeah.
Yes, I remember that.
It used to serve.
Yes, quite a difference. Yeah. Now. You can see the old road.
Pond. Yeah.
Exactly. And it goes by
Cleveland. By Cleveland.
Yeah. Something I've always been curious about, and maybe you know, on the Hotchkiss property, just about by the boathouse, there's remains of it. When we came here, an old ice house. Did they cut ice? Did Hotchkiss cut ice?
They cut ice. Oh, certainly. I thought when I came back, the teeth were still cutting ice. They had an ice house there. The kitchen at Hotchkiss was quite primitive. They had no refrigerators at all. And they had a big ice house, which was full of blocks of ice, which were cut by horses, which pulled knives or saws. And they cut out a big rectangular section of ice, dragged, I guess that's what the horses did, they dragged the ice to the ice house, and somehow by block and tackle pulled it in, covered it with sawdust. The ice would be cut through the year and without completely melting.
And they dragged that ice all the way up that hill to the kitchen?
And then that's what the horses would do. Would bring blocks of ice up. Yeah. In fact, I can remember when I was teaching here, two or three boys on one nice night, when the lake was frozen, snuck out of the dormitory, went down the lake, put on their skates, and were skating on the ice. They were skating backwards, as a matter of fact, at one point, and fell right into the hole where they'd been cutting ice. And so that stopped that little thing, and they quickly came back to school soaking wet. very cold, only to find that their dormitory room was locked. So they were caught, and I think were sent home, unfortunately. But that, I don't remember when they changed over from ICE, but the ICE house remained there for quite a long while. Now the only thing left is a water spigot that stands up about 2 feet high. That's exactly what it was. I suppose that was to wash the sawdust off the ice when they took it out of the ice house.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And the kitchen, where they didn't have refrigerators, really was quite primitive. It, at least by our standards then, I think the cooking was all done in the bottom level. And we brought up by elevators or bumped them right into the floor above. They baked everything, as I guess they still do, right there in their own bake shop. But it seems incredible that they come over with ice and school outside.
I just wonder, did you as a student ever use the lake? I mean, did you skate across the town when the ice was solid?
Of course, and we use it a lot more than they do now, because actually school, the seniors anyway, ran well into the middle of June, and because seniors took college boards after graduation, so they, therefore, the boathouse, which had lockers for, I don't know, about 24 canoes, it was pretty much full of canoes, so students would use the lake for canoeing. Sailing was not allowed in those days, so it was either swimming or canoeing. And in the winter, I'm sure that we skated in the village. And I think every student that did it felt that he was the first person ever to have skated across the lake. And it is kind of fun. I remember going to the Salisbury Bank and Trust to make a deposit with my shoes tied around my neck and skating to the Grove and then taking them off. The Grove, I suppose, was there. I don't remember it being as beautiful as it is now. Of course, there was no sailing at all, I don't think, on the lake. I don't think there were any sailboats, mostly canoes. John Cardoza, who ran the ground school at Hotchkiss, had an ice boat, a gigantic ice boat, which he would put together if the ice was right and sail around. And after he left or died, I know that his ice boat was willed to Elmer Lindsay and somebody else. And I can remember these characters one winter putting the thing together and launching it on the ice and sailing around the lake. They didn't really know much about sailing, but they had a lot of fun.
What was the house behind the football field when we first came here? Somebody lived back there, and I don't think the house is even there.
I don't think it is either. That's where Charlie Chappell lived. His name was actually Charlie Robertson, and his job was, he was English. His job was to really be janitor in the chapel. That's why he's called Charlie Chappell, of course. His brother was around in the area. I didn't know him, but he was in the linoleum business, I think, or floor cover business. I can't think of his first name, but Robertson. And Charlie Chappell, as he was called, lived all by himself in this house down there, which I'm sure it's been a town. It was almost a long time. And the only thing I remember about him is that when he was in England, he was in the paper-making business, and handmade paper. And if you wanted to spend about an hour and a half, you could go in the chapel and find him and say, Charlie, you don't even know anything about making paper? And he would get out pieces of paper and explain how it was done and show you how the paper in the Bible was made and so forth and so on. And he would walk every morning up from Long Pond to work. And always had a lower temperature to report than anybody in the area. I always thought he made it up. But There are some other houses. I think the Cuddies have a house down there, but that's on the right. His was on the left.
Yeah, it was the Hotchkiss Road down to
Little Baker.
And they just let it fall apart and die?
I guess so. I don't know. There was another foundation hole for a while down there where the school dumped leaves. I remember they filled that in. But that's not the same place. I think that maybe it was torn down. Because it wasn't a regular repair then. Really. But I think it did have electricity. Because I can remember light wires going past Little Baker down to a lot of fun. But I remember we hung a hammer up on the bus. And the boy was throwing the hammer.
Do you remember a camp that is now, I think the town owns the property, and it was on Long Pond Road. Over on the way toward
the Cedars,
exactly. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I never could understand what it was exactly, because they had a little golf course, I think a 9-hole golf course. They had a, of course, boating and swimming at Long Pond, which in those days wasn't too bad. But when you were playing golf on the Hotchkiss golf course, you could often hear their loudspeaker calling for a member of the Cedars. I think it was a club, or maybe it was a hotel, but anyway, a resort, I guess. But they would page, you know, Dr. somebody, so loud that you could hear him on their golf course and hear him over the Long Pond, you could hear him on our golf course. And then it sort of it folded and it deteriorated. And then, of course, the town somehow bought back and got it and they bought it and given to them.
I think it was given to them.
I don't know whether there are any buildings there or not. I haven't been back.
I went down once in the spring.
And I don't know whether the town has done much really. It's a nice area in some way. But
did you use Long Pond at all?
As a student, no. We used the woods, and groups of people built cabins. I was not involved in cabin building, but except as a friend and whatnot, a few things. Some were pretty good. I got lost, though there were ski trails in those buildings. We didn't use Long Pond. But we certainly used the lake a lot in the spring. We didn't use it in the fall at all.
Anything else?
I don't think I've gone through.
George is going to add something else here.
And two other items that occurred to me. When we were talking about the jigger shop back in the days when I was a student and a young master, I remember there was a fellow who would drop in at the jigger shop, and his name was Hen Day, and he was rather famous. I never really understood much about him. He was sort of the town bum. That's probably not the right word. I think he came from some home for indigent or retarded or whatever, and he would be back. He didn't make a lot of sense. He was no trouble. He wasn't a drunk. He was famous because if when you're talking to him, in the middle of the conversation, he would belch loudly. And that, of course, made a lot of jokes. I think he was really the ward of the town. That's my guess. The other little thing that I forgot was that Doc Leverty, who ran the drugstore, was really quite a character, and people liked to make fun of him. And it was known that Doc Leverty put on chains early in the fall in preparation for winter, left the chains on until April or May, until there was no more snow or ice. And one day, in the late spring, Abe Martin's garage which was located where the mobile station of the Eric Travel Company is. Dave Martin's garage caught fire. The local businessman said that the fire started from sparks caused by Doc Leverty's chains as he drove home for lunch. Probably not true. Okay, thanks. I think that's it.
That's it.